The whisky had begun to warm him, but he was unprepared for the sudden blaze that flashed upward inside him from belly to head. He was standing looking at the shelf where the skiff was, only the foolish skiff was not there. For the second time that day, the fisherman felt the deep vacuity of disbelief. He gaped, seeing nothing but the flat shelf of rock. He whirled, started towards the boys, slipped, recovered himself, fetched a complete circle, and stared at the unimaginably empty shelf. Its emptiness made him feel as if everything he had done that day so far, his life so far, he had dreamed. What could have happened? The tide was still nearly a foot below. There'd be no sea to speak of. The skiff could hardly have slid off by itself. For the life of him, consciously careful as he inveterately was, he could not now remember hauling it up the last time. Perhaps in the heat of hunting he'd left it to the boy. Perhaps he couldn't remember which was the last time. "Christ!" he exclaimed loudly without realizing it, because he was so entranced by the invisible event. "What's wrong, Dad?" asked his son, getting to his feet. The fisherman went blind with uncontainable rage. "Get back down there where you belong!" he screamed. He scarcely noticed the boy sink back in amazement. In a frenzy, he ran along the ledge, thinking the skiff might have been drawn up at another place. Although he knew better, there was no other place. He stumbled, half falling, back to the boys who were gawking at him in consternation, as though he'd gone insane. "God damn it!" he yelled savagely, grabbing both of them and yanking them to their knees. "Get on your feet!" "What's wrong?" his son repeated in a stifled voice. "Never mind what's wrong," he snarled. "Look for the skiff. It's adrift." When they peered around, he gripped their shoulders, brutally facing them about. "Downwind!" He slammed his fist against his thigh. "Jesus!" he cried, struck to madness at their stupidity. At last he sighted the skiff himself, magically bobbing along the grim sea like a toller, a quarter of a mile to leeward, on a distant course for home. The impulse to strip himself naked was succeeded instantly by a queer calm. He simply sat down on the ledge and forgot everything except the marvellous mystery. As his awareness partially returned, he glanced towards the boys. They were still observing the skiff speechlessly. Then he was gazing into the clear young eyes of his son. "Dad," asked the boy steadily, "what do we do now?" That brought the fisherman upright. "The first thing we have to do," he heard himself saying with infinite tenderness, as if he were making love, "is think." "Could you swim it?" asked his son. He shook his head and smiled at them. They smiled quickly back, too quickly. "100 yards, maybe, in this water." "I wish I could," he added. It was the most intimate and pitiful thing he'd ever said. He walked in circles round them, trying to break the stall his mind was left in. He gauged the level of the water. To the eye it was quite stationary, 6 inches from the shelf at this second. The fisherman did not have to mark it on the side of the rock against the passing of time to prove to his reason that it was rising, always rising. Already it was over the brink of reason, beyond the margins of thought, a senseless measurement. No sense to it. All his life, the fisherman had tried to lick the element of time by getting up earlier and going to bed later, owning a faster boat, planning more than the day would hold, and tackling just one other job before the deadline fell. If, as on rare occasions, he had the grand illusion he ever really had beaten the game, he would need to call on all his reserves of practice and cunning now. He sized up the scant but unforgivable 300 yards to Brown Cow Island. Another 100 yards behind it, his boat rode at anchor, where, had he been aboard, he could have cut in a fathometer to plumb the profound and occult seas, or a ship-to-shore radio on which, in an interminably short time, he would have heard his wife's voice talking to him over the air about homecoming. "Couldn't we wave something so somebody would see us?" his nephew suggested. The fisherman spun round. "Load your guns," he ordered. They loaded as if the air had suddenly gone frantic with birds. I'll fire once and count to five. Then you fire. Count to five. That way they won't just think it's only somebody gunning ducks. We'll keep doing that. We've only got just 2.5 boxes left, said his son. The fisherman nodded, understanding that from beginning to end their situation was purely mathematical, like the ticking of the alarm clock in his silent bedroom. Then he fired. The dog, who'd been keeping watch over the decoys, leapt forward and yelped in confusion. They all counted off, fired the first 5 rounds by 3s and reloaded. The fisherman scanned first the horizon, then the contracting borders of the ledge, which was the sole place the water appeared to be climbing. Soon it would be over the shelf. They counted off and fired the second 5 rounds. "We'll hold off a while on the last one," the fisherman told the boys. He sat down and pondered. What a trivial thing was a skiff. The one he and the boy had knocked together in a day was a gun, manufactured for killing. His son tallied up the remaining shells, grouping them symmetrically in 3s on the rock when the wet box fell apart. "Too short," he announced. They reloaded and laid the guns on their knees.
Thank you. So there's a fantastic, I think, a fantastic piece of plotting, a kind of symmetry here, because, you know, earlier on he's left his tobacco at home and he has that sort of moment, that sort of sinking feeling. Mm-hmm. And in a way it's the end of the world for him, but we as the reader say, well, it's not the end of the world, he's only left his tobacco at home. And this time he's also slipped up a little bit, but now it really is the end of the world, and the sinking feeling becomes almost a sort of a cataclysmic,
yeah.
You know, the ground dropping out from beneath his feet.
Yes. Yeah, and I think the two lines that Sergeant Hall writes are extraordinary. You know, a lesser writer would have gone into great descriptions of fear and trepidation and the what-ifs and, oh God, the children, and oh God this, oh God... And all he says is, the impulse to strip himself naked was succeeded instantly by a queer calm. He sat down on the ledge and forgot everything except the marvellous mystery. I mean, that is just unbelievably good as far as I'm concerned as a writer. Those lines sort of open up into a whole world of what's going on inside this man's head, and it can't do anything but reflect for you. You know, it's like you're suddenly confronted with a mirror. How would I react in that situation? Mm-hmm. And you're confronted with nothing but your own mortality. And the impulse to strip himself naked, all he is a man. And it's the start of that process of stripping away all the things that don't matter from that point.
Mm.
It is such a momentous thing that you almost can't quite look it in the eye. That he has to let it surround him. And it is beginning to go in through all the pores. It's quite an extraordinary moment.
Mm. But I suppose it's made even more extraordinary, or certainly more challenging, because he's got children there. So he can't just be... Because I suppose in some way you become a child again yourself, don't you? You become a helpless child. But he also has to be the strong... invincible, I know what I'm going to sort of,
yeah.
I know what's going on, I know how I'm going to fix this adult.
Yes, this is the test now on lots of different levels for this man. And he hasn't got anything else that he can hide behind. I think that's the thing. And you're back to the stripping naked again. He can only be what he seriously and honestly is in his heart. He has got no other option. And that doesn't mean you're going back to being a child. It means acknowledging the responsibility that you have as a father. And that's what now takes over. Yeah.
And what is that responsibility?
I think it's very difficult to put into words, but I think the responsibility we all have to our children is to make sure they have the wherewithal to live as well as they can. And I don't mean money when I say live as well as they can. Be as good a human being as you can be, I think is probably what I mean. And I don't think there's any difference here. He suddenly has a responsibility to his son to make sure that his son has the best possible chance in life. Literally, now. However long that life is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no different. And the stripping away process that has begun takes away those slightly meaningless things that we surround ourselves with, about what things we've got, about the competition, who shoots the most, who's got a bigger boat than the other man, who earns better, each man for himself, in a materialistic sense. We've moved beyond that now.
Mm. It's suddenly become very, very elemental, hasn't it? I love some of the comments that Anthony Is it Dürr? I never know how to pronounce his name.
I always think Dürr, actually.
Okay. Yeah. You know, he says two that I think really chime in with what you've just said. Good stories are first and foremost about creating an engrossing, concrete, physical tension, and I just wonder if which this story does, but there is something in a way to do that. You need to be in contact with, and I think your stories do this as well, in contact with those quite elemental forces of life, and to sort of really understand them at some sort of level.
Gosh. I think I'd need a day to digest that one. I certainly think that you need to have an understanding and a real love of being alive, so that you can understand how it is when that possibility might be taken away from you, if that makes any sense at all. And I've always, you know, on a personal note here, I was an adopted child, and I'm very, very lucky that I was conceived in the 1950s. Had I been conceived in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, or now, I would not have been here. Somebody would probably have made the decision that it was much simpler and easier to dispose of the potential that was going to be Vanessa, you know, in a very simple medical procedure. And I've been aware of that incredibly consciously for a very, very long time. And that if I had not been here, my sons would not be here, and now my granddaughter. And I'm very glad I am, thank you, and I'm very glad they are. And it's this sense that I've got that, you know, life really is precious. And so you get to a pivotal moment like this in a story, and it can't help but, if it's done well, which this man does, but grab you by the heart and squeeze.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's keep on squeezing.
Behind thickening clouds, they could not see the sun going down. The water coming up was growing blacker. The fisherman thought he might have told his wife they would be home before dark, since it was Christmas Day. he realised he'd forgotten about its being any particular day. The tide would not be high until 2 hours after sunset. When they did not get in by nightfall and could not be raised by radio, she might send somebody to hunt for them right away. He rejected this arithmetic immediately with a sickening shock, recollecting it was a 2.5 hour run at best. Then it occurred to him that she might send somebody on the mainland who was nearer. She would think he had engine trouble. He rose and searched the shoreline, barely visible. Then his glance dropped to the toy shoreline at the edges of the reef. The shrinking ledge, so sinister from a boat, grew dearer minute by minute, as though the whole wide world he gazed on, from horizon to horizon, balanced on its contracting rim. He checked the water level and found the shelf awash. Some of what went through his mind the fisherman told to the boys. They accepted it without comment. If he caught their eyes, they looked away to spare him, or because they were not yet old enough to face what they saw. Mostly, they watched the rising water. The fisherman was unable to initiate a word of encouragement. He wanted one of them to ask him whether somebody would reach them ahead of the tide. He would have found it impossible to say yes, but they did not inquire. The fisherman was not sure how much at their age they were able to imagine. Both of them had seen from the docks drowned bodies put ashore out of boats. Sometimes they grasped things and sometimes not. He supposed they might be longing for the comfort of their mothers, and was astonished, as much as he was capable of any astonishment except the supreme one, to discover himself wishing he had not left his wife's dark, close, naked bed that morning. "Is it time to shoot now?" asked his nephew. "Pretty soon," he said, as if he were putting off making good on a promise. "Not yet." His own boy cried softly for a brief moment, like a man, his face averted in an effort neither to give or show pain. "Before school starts," the fisherman said, wonderfully detached, "we'll go to town and I'll buy you boys anything you want." With great difficulty, in a dull tone, as though he did not in the least desire it, his son said after a pause, "I'd like one of those new 30-horse outboards." "All right," said the fisherman. "And to his nephew?" "How about you?" The nephew shook his head desolately. "I don't want anything," he said. After another pause, the fisherman's son said, "Yes, he does, Dad. He wants one too." "All right," the fisherman said, and said no more. The dog whined in uncertainty and licked the boys' faces where they sat together. Each threw an arm over his back and hugged him. 3 strays flew in and sat companionably down among the stiff-necked decoys. The dog crouched, obedient to his training. The boys observed them listlessly. Presently, sensing something untoward, the ducks took off, splashing the wavetops with feet and wingtips into the dusky waste. The sea began to make up in the mounting wind, and the wind bore a new and deathly chill. The fisherman, scouring the sombre, dwindling shadow of the mainland for a sign, hoped it would not snow, but it did. First a few flakes, then a flurry, then storming past horizontally. The fisherman took one long, bewildered look at Brown Cow Island, 300 yards to leeward, and got to his feet. Then it shut in, as if what was happening on the ledge was too private even for the last wan light of the expiring day. "Last round," the fisherman said austerely. The boys rose and shouldered their tacit guns. The fisherman fired into the flying snow. He counted methodically to 5. His son fired and counted. His nephew. All 3 fired and counted. 4 rounds. "You've got 1 left, Dad," his son said. The fisherman hesitated another second. Then he fired the final shell. Its pathetic report, like the spat of a popgun, whipped away on the wind and was instantly blanketed in falling snow. Night fell, all in a moment, to meet the ascending sea. They were now barely able to make one another out through driving snowflakes, dim as ghosts in their yellow oilskins. The fisherman heard a sea break and glanced down where his feet were. They seemed to be wound in a snowy sheet. Gently he took the boys by the shoulders and pushed them in front of him, feeling with his feet along the shallow sump to the place where it triangulated into a sharp crevice at the highest point of the ledge. "Face ahead," he told them. "Put the guns down." "I'd like to hold mine, Dad," begged his son. "Put it down," said the fisherman. "The tide won't hurt it. Now brace your feet against both sides and stay there." They felt the dog, who was pitch black, running up and down in perplexity between their straggled legs. "Dad," said his son, "what about the pooch?" If he'd called the dog by name, it would have been too personal. The fisherman would have wept. As it was, he had all he could do to keep from laughing. He bent his knees, and when he touched, the dog hoisted him. He bent his knees, and when he touched the dog, hoisted him under one arm. The dog's belly was soaking wet. So they waited, marooned in their consciousness, surrounded by a monstrous tidal space which was slowly, slowly closing them out. In this space, the periwinkle between the fisherman's boots was king. While hovering airborne in his mind, he had an inward glimpse of his house, as curiously separate, like a June mirage. Snow, rocks, seas, wind, the fisherman had lived by all his life. Now, he thought, he had never comprehended what they were, and he hated them, though they had not changed. He was deadly chilled. He set out to ask the boys if they were cold. There was no sense. He thought of the whiskey and sidled backward, still holding the awkward dog, till he located the bottle under water with his toe. He picked it up, squeamishly, as though afraid of getting his sleeve wet, worked his way forward and bent over his son. "Drink it," he said, holding the bottle against the boy's ribs. The boy tipped his head back, drank, coughed hotly, then vomited. "I can't," he told his father wretchedly. "Try, try," the fisherman pleaded, as if it meant the difference between life and death. The boy obediently drank, and again he vomited hotly. He shook his head against his father's chest and passed the bottle forward to his cousin, who drank and vomited also. Passing the bottle back, the boys dropped it in the frigid water between them. When the waves reached his knees, the fisherman set the warm dog loose and said to his son, "Turn round and get up on my shoulders." The boy obeyed. The fisherman opened his oilskin jacket and twisted his hands behind him through his suspenders, clamping the boy's booted ankles with his elbows. "What about the dog?" the boy asked. "He'll make his own way all right," the fisherman said. "He can take the cold water." His knees were trembling. Every instinct shrieked for gymnastics. He ground his teeth and braced like a colossus against the sides of the submerged crevice. The dog, having lived faithfully as though one of them for 11 years, swam a few minutes in and out round the fisherman's legs, not knowing what was happening, and left them without a whimper. He would swim and swim at random by himself, round and round in the blinding night. And when he had swum routinely through the paralysing water all he could, he would simply, in one incomprehensible moment, drown. Almost, the fisherman, waiting out infinity, envied him his pattern. Freezing seas swept by, flooding inexorably up and up as the earth sank away imperceptibly beneath them. The boy called out once to his cousin. There was no answer. The fisherman, marvelling on a terror without voice, was dumbly glad when the boy did not call again. His own boots were long full of water. With no sensation left in his straddling legs, he dared not move them. So long as the seas came sideways against his hips and then sideways against his shoulders, he might balance. No telling how long. The upper half of him was what felt frozen. His legs, disengaged from his nerves and his will, he came to regard quite scientifically. They were the absurd, precarious axis around which reeled and surged universal tumult. The waves would come on and on. He could not visualize how many tossing reinforcements lurked in the night beyond, inexhaustible numbers, and he wept in supernatural fury at each, because it was higher, till he transcended hate and took them, swaying like a convert, one by one, as they lunged against him and away aimlessly into their own undisputed wild realm. From his hips upward, the fisherman stretched to his utmost, as a man does whose spirit reaches out of dead sleep. The boy's head, none too high, must be at least 7 feet above the ledge. Though growing larger every minute, it was a small, light life. The fisherman meant to hold it there, if need be, through 1,000 tides. By and by, the boy, slumped on the head of his father, asked, "Is it over your boots yet, Dad?" "Not yet," the fisherman said. Then through his teeth he added, "If I fall, kick your boots off. Swim for it, downwind, to the island." "You?" the boy finally asked. The fisherman nodded against the boy's belly. "Won't see each other," he said. The boy did for the fisherman the greatest thing that can be done. He may have been too young for perfect terror, but he was old enough to know there were things beyond the power of any man. All he could do, he did, by trusting his father to do all he could, and asking nothing more. The fisherman, rocked to his soul by a sea, held his eyes shut upon the interminable night. "Is it time now?" the boy said. The fisherman could hardly speak. "Not yet," he said. "Not just yet." As the landmass pivoted towards sunlight the day after Christmas, a tiny fleet of small craft converged offshore like iron filings to a magnet. At daybreak, they found the skiff floating unscathed off the headland, half full of ducks and snow. The shooting had been good, as someone hearing on the nearby mainland the previous afternoon had supposed. 2 hours afterward, they found the unharmed boat adrift 5 miles at sea. At high noon, they found the fisherman at ebb tide, his right foot jammed cruelly into a glacial crevice of the ledge, beside 3 shotguns. His hands tangled behind him in his suspenders, and under his right elbow a rubber boot with a sock and a live starfish in it. After dragging unlit depths all day for the boys, they towed the fisherman home in his own boat at sundown. And in the frost of evening, mute with discovering purgatory, laid him on his wharf for his wife to see. She, somehow, standing on the dock as in her frequent dream, gazing at the fisherman pure as crystal on the icy boards, a small rubber boot still frozen under one clenched arm, saw him exaggerated beyond remorse or grief, absolved of his mortality.
Thank you. That's a beautifully, beautifully judged reading. I mean, there are a number of real sort of lump-in-the-throat moments in these last few pages. The one that always does it for me is when he's talking about the dog, and he says if he'd called the dog by name, it would have been too personal. The fisherman would have wept. And actually, only today, reading this, which had never really dawned on me before, I wondered if perhaps he had Larry Hall, as Anthony Doerr calls him, Larry Hall, if Larry Hall had decided, maybe not even consciously, not to call the fisherman, or to give a fisherman a name, because that would have almost made it possibly too personal. It would have...
There's not many things I'm sure about in anybody's processes, but I think 80% of me says that it was a conscious decision not to give the fisherman a name, or the boys.
Because
then it makes it much more generic. He is every man. He's not John or Jim or George, all of which would have diminished him, I think.
And he is us. I mean, he can become us much more, can't he, rather than a separate,
exactly,
a separate,
I think,
named figure.
I think in this particular instance, as a reader, if you read it closely, you identify with him. And I think if he was called Cuthbert, that might stand in the way. That is said sort of tongue-in-cheek, half-tongue-in-cheek, but it would, wouldn't it? It really would. It would solidify him into one man. And it's not needed. It's a very interesting thing. I think a lot of writers, when they're starting out, perhaps don't name their characters, and you get stories that are all full of he's and she's, and it's a mistake and it doesn't work. But here you're in the hands of a master who shows you this does work, but the themes of the story have to be so weighty and that it can take that, if that makes any sense.
So what for you in these last few pages, these lump-in-the-throat laden pages, which for you is the biggest lump in the throat? I mean, where does it sort of emotionally hook you?
Well, the whole story does now, obviously. I mean, I must have read this 30, 40 times, the story at least. I mean, there are very obvious places. There are three times that the boy asks, is it time yet? I think the first one is about the shooting, and then, you know, and each one you know that that's just the shadow, and then the next one's just the shadow, and the actual hard stone of the fact is coming. It is those moments where you hear them talking, and you hear the child's questions, and you hear these responses from the father who is giving the son half the truth, and the son knows, and there's a trust there. There's these amazing line, all he could do he did by trusting his father to do all he could. The way that relationship works at that moment is an extraordinary thing, and I think there's that very strange sense that I get that it's a privilege to have that relationship with these characters, playing that out with me involved in it emotionally, because I'm unlikely to meet that intensity in any truthful way and in any sense at all. And so I think it's doing in the most pure way what fiction can do, and that is showing you sort of little diamond moments that you're unlikely to meet yourself. And I don't mean literally with the water rising, but in relationship terms, where it's distilled down to a man who is at the point of dying as the water rises up and it's snowing. He is freezing. He's literally freezing. And he can just get the words out, not yet. And, you know, those words are quite powerful. He dies for his son, even in the knowledge that his son is going to die, probably. But he gives him that last possible chance by fixing his body so rigidly with the boy above him that there's just that moment, that possible moment, that if he is 7 feet above the ledge, there's just a chance that the waves are not going to get the boy. And so the father does all he possibly can do for his son, and that is this distillation of what is parenthood, what is being a human. We are here, we try, and, you know, if you're talking genes, you make sure, if you can, that your progeny carries on. But morally, he's doing all he possibly can do for that boy. That last sentence, where, you know, interestingly, you've got now your back in the point of view, obviously, of the wife, as the story started in her point of view. So there's beautiful shapes going on here.
How do you read that last sentence? Because I don't fully understand that last sentence. Clenched on, saw him exaggerated beyond remorse or grief, absolved of his mortality.
Gosh. Well, if you work backwards and you come from the point that this character embodies what it is to be human, what it is to be immortal. And the word absolution in there. And the fact that if you go back in the story, this character was stubborn, you know that he was a bully, he'd not been very nice to his wife. You know, you can list quite a few of the sins in here, if you like, if you want to be sort of classically minded about it. And as things have got closer and closer and closer to the death of the man, there's that moment, I think I said, well, for me, where he talks about wanting to strip naked. That is the moment at which all these things start falling away. And so you're left with nothing but absolution for all those things. And the fact that the boot is still there, that is, it is so, so, so important. The man is frozen to death. There's no sign of the boys. But she can see what he's done because of how he is. He's like a statue. And, you know, whether it's rigor mortis or frozen, he has got his hands behind him and the boy's boot is still under that arm. So she can see what he did. And maybe in that moment, the realisation is just it's too much. She sees him exaggerated, made greater in her own head. She can't perhaps take it in. If we're being absolutely realistic. So she can't feel remorse. She can't feel grief. It's like his being frozen has come into her. And the overriding emotion that she's feeling is an understanding of this absolution, this transcendence above humanity, above being mortal. I think the first time I read it, I felt, that at that moment I'd been so involved with this story, I was completely out of it. And I had, when that final moment has happened, and you're then, in sort of filmic terms, seeing this frozen body, you know, almost like stone or ice, there's no colour in there, everything's gone. It was almost like you were glimpsing something that happens after death, but not being able to look at it straight. And I can't describe it any more than that. The more you try and analyse your own reactions to things, the less able you are to do it. But I felt that Lawrence Sargent Hall was showing me something through his story, which was almost a mystical something, which is going to sound very wishy-washy and ridiculous and all the rest of it, but that was the sense that you got. It was that the strength of that final few lines is unlike anything else. Mm.